Malcolm X was one of the two dominant Afro-American leaders during the decade of black protest in the 1960s. His leadership stood as a major alternative to that of Dr. Martin Luther King, the more familiar and well-known of the two. Unlike Dr. King, too much of what Malcolm X stood for was unacceptable to the system. It would just as soon have Afro-Americans forget Malcolm X as it wanted everyone to forget Paul Robeson. 22 years after his assassination and 62 years after his birth, Malcolm has yet to receive the silent treatment and universal acknowledgement he deserves as the most legitimately proletarian leader the Afro-American community has ever produced. Malcolm X was prominent for a very short period of time, possibly no more than 5 years. In that time, he was much more a public speaker and agitator than an intellectual bequeathing extensive library of books. Much of his popularity resulted from the deft manipulation of the mass media, a media with notable exceptions silent or critical of his legacy after his death. At the time of his death, Malcolm X was still refining his synthesis of the Afro-American liberation struggle and the international struggle of third world peoples against racist Euro-American imperialism. His presentation of this synthesis was not as strong as it would have ultimately been had he lived. In order to effect this synthesis, it was necessary for Malcolm to leave his disciplined organizational base of the Nation of Islam, but his newfound organization of Afro-American unity had yet to mature as a highly disciplined organization by the time he was struck down, but was unable to defend and nurture his legacy after his assassination. Unfortunately, a host of organizations and tendencies unwittingly aided and abetted the government-directed obfuscation of Malcolm's legacy as they struggled to claim the mantle of Malcolm's leadership of the ghettoized black masses. The struggle for Malcolm's legacy continues. Its outcome is of crucial importance to the furtherance of the struggle for black liberation. To understand black leadership and the black movement of the 1960s, both King and Malcolm X must be critically analyzed and studied. And one should note James Cone's insightful analysis, which is the beginning of, I know, many major projects to do this important historical task. Malcolm X is as important as Martin Luther King, without question. Without restoring Malcolm X to his rightful place, it will be impossible to understand the motion of the 1960s and the lessons to be extracted from the decade therein. We must study the full range of ideological and political points made by Malcolm in terms of their relevance to the situation of black people today. But the life of Malcolm was a complex one, full of change, dynamism, contradiction, and development. He was a worker, a lumpen, an imam, a political leader, an international diplomat, a propagandist, and a political theorist. Each of these aspects of his identity raises basic questions which must be answered. How do we periodize Malcolm's life? His political development, his political thoughts. We must recognize that the thinking of Malcolm X is controversial. Malcolm X addressed ideological issues which even today are at the center of debate within the black liberation movement. While Malcolm held up the nationalist flag in his debate with the integrationists, he advanced his arguments in such a way as to raise up the more fundamental issues of the class, character, of the various contending ideas for liberation in the black community. As well, he raised up the political role and class content of various aspects of Afro-American culture. Nevertheless, his legacy charges not so much to choose between race and class as explanatory variables, but to discover the relationship and interpenetration of these two most important aspects of Afro-American reality. Moreover, the study of Malcolm X raises interesting methodological questions. How do we research a working class intellectual whose written legacy is limited? How do we determine that such a working class intellectual is a theorist? Where is Malcolm situated in the Afro-American intellectual tradition? What is Malcolm's place among 20th century revolutionary thinkers? Many of these questions can be answered definitively only after a major research effort on the part of a collective body of scholars, gathering all of the documentation of what actually took place and analyzing it from all. What is Malcolm's place among 20th century revolutionary thinkers? Many of these questions can be answered definitively only after a major research effort on the part of a collective body of scholars, gathering all of the documentation of what actually took place and analyzing it from all academic disciplines. The competition of contending points of view can, under such circumstances, be clarified based on the basis of objective reality, based on truth. This is the only acceptable approach to historical knowledge, documented evidence. Malcolm X, in my opinion, was a black revolutionary nationalist, implacably struggling to destroy the racist monopoly capitalist system which is the United States of America. He was an outsider trying to bring down the system, not join it. His following was extensive, mass-based, and disciplined. By the end of 1964, Malcolm X had secured international support for his movement and won official recognition from the Organization of African Unity. The American government saw his leadership as dangerous and moved to expedite the destruction of his person and his legacy. February 21st, 1965, of course, Malcolm fell at the hands of an assassin, but the struggle to redeem his legacy continues. The American ruling class has attempted to destroy as much of Malcolm's legacy as possible, repress what remains indestructible, and distort the meaning of that part of his legacy, which can neither be destroyed nor repressed. This article, then, is a brief survey of the significance of Malcolm then and now, and stands as a small contribution to the major effort necessary to restore Malcolm X to a proper place in the pantheon of revolutionaries. Some observations about Malcolm X, the revolutionary. Malcolm X stood squarely in the revolutionary national tradition of Martin Robeson Delaney and Bishop Henry McNeil Turner. His stance was objectively revolutionary, as were these precursors of his, because Malcolm's rhetoric was a kind of classic in attacking the mythology of the American dream, the major intellectual prop of civil rights reformism. He pushed the debate of means and ends beyond the parameters established by the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. Especially after his break with the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X became quite sensitive to the relationship of reform struggles to revolutionary development. His Ballad of the Bullet speech, by pinpointing the alternative futures of the struggle, took that struggle for the ballot beyond reformism. In this sense, Malcolm X is the intellectual father of independent black politics. By restoring the tradition of revolutionary black nationalism to the civil rights protest of the early 60s, Malcolm X rescued this. By restoring the tradition of revolutionary black nationalism to the civil rights protest of the early 60s, Malcolm X rescued the civil rights movement from the reformers' cul-de-sac within which it was rapidly being entrapped. His insistence on the inherent right of self-defense by any means necessary was not a novel pronouncement in the history of the Afro-American liberation struggle. Rather, it resurrected the antebellum protest tradition associated with the likes of David Walker and Reverend Henry Hyman Garnett, both of whom called upon the slaves to rebel and destroy their slave masters. Malcolm's militancy on the question of violence touched the same emotive chord in the psyche of the black masses today that the sentiments of Walker and Garnett struck in the bosom of Nat Turner, the slave preacher whose rebellion in Virginia in 1831 traumatized the slaveocracy. While the articulation of the question of revolutionary violence by Malcolm X legitimized sentiments long rooted in the urbanized black masses, he increasingly appealed to the black student activist and intelligentsia, being radicalized by their experience and struggle. By the end of 1963, more and more Southern civil rights workers were losing faith in non-violent direct action as a way of life. Most civil rights cadres had not made the unequivocal philosophical acceptance of non-violence as King had done. They saw it merely as a tactic increasingly unable to achieve even the most modest of goals. Demoralization and cynicism spread rapidly among these cadres, since alternatives to nonviolence were not easily discussed on their merits, being considered heresy by the Orthodox leadership. Robert Williams of Monroe, South Carolina, for instance, was read out of the NAACP for advocating self-defense against racist night riders in his community. The Deacons for Self-Defense caused quite a stir within CORE when they began to provide armed escort for nonviolent demonstrators in Platteville County, Louisiana. Snake cadres in the Mississippi Delta were all but driven insane, attempting to uphold the nonviolent imperative in the face of the savage beatings they endured during the voter registration campaigns. By 1965, it was a revolutionary nationalist thought of Malcolm X, not the King philosophy of nonviolence, which resonated sympathetically with the experiences of civil rights workers in the Deep South. By opening up the debate again on the question of revolutionary violence and reestablishing its place in the traditional arsenal of Afro-American resistance and struggle, Malcolm X paved the way for the appearance in the United States of Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, which by 1965-66 had wrestled the intellectual and moral high ground from King's grounding in nonviolence among radicalized movement intelligentsia. If I could just add a little footnote here from the experience I had several weeks ago. I live in Harlem on 13th Street, had a place called Boulevard. And I had called to strike up a conversation in the subway while I was waiting for my young daughter to come home with some neighbors of mine who around 50, 55 years old, ex-junkies themselves, natural ex-junkies. Well, initially when I went to the subway, I had taken a copy of Fanon, I was reviewing it again, on question of culture, what have you. And I just looked down and said, "What you got there?" I said, "Well, it's Franz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth." "Oh man, we read that 20 years ago." All right? So we struck up a conversation on that basis. What's interesting here is the intensely sophisticated political culture of Harlem, which was one of the formative influences on the political development of Malcolm, as both an activist and a theorist. And one could imagine being leadership of a political culture where even the junkies read Fanon, you know, in 1964 and 65. So Malcolm very much is not only a product of his own individual endowment, but a product of that whole milieu, which is particularly what we call Harlem, an intensely political and nationalist environment. Malcolm X was a theorist of the politics of culture. The political ideology of Malcolm X placed the highest value on the achievement of black unity. To him, black unity would be the primary means by which black people would achieve liberation. However, Malcolm felt that racial unity required, in part, a reconstructed image of Afro-American culture. To understand Malcolm's reconstruction required an explicit treatment of the impact of class on Afro-American culture and an essentially political conception of the Afro-American's cultural heritage. Through the analysis of the House Nigger Field Nigger dialectic, Malcolm not only exposed the social, historical, and cultural origins of slavery, of the contemporary debate between integration and nationalism, but its class character as well. This political role that Malcolm assigned Afro-American culture is not viable unless the class character, the main cultural trends in the black community, is identified. For Malcolm, then, the significance of any cultural trend in the black community was a function of its impact on the struggle for black liberation. Of course, the Afro-American conception of Africa is a centerpiece of the cultural renaissance Malcolm desired. Nevertheless, the role of Africa in the thinking of Malcolm is essentially political. The advocacy of a cultural identification with Africa is not advanced as an end in itself. It is a means by which Afro-Americans can reclaim their psyches and their self-respect in order to fight back against racism and exploitation in the Western Hemisphere. Here I would somewhat depart from the analysis of Obed Shaka in his most recent work on Malcolm, in that he fixes Malcolm's fascination with Africa as part of a long-range strategy which he associates with Garvey and Garveyism, that it's a long-range objective on the part of Malcolm in terms of a physical return to Africa. My reading, especially the latter year to 18 months of Malcolm's life, is that Africa is not so much important as an ultimate refuge or an ultimate homeland, but as part of a whole process on the one hand of the psychological reconstruction for the fight at home, and secondly, in terms of counteracting the imperialist propaganda that suggested that given the minority status of blacks in the United States, there were only a limited range of options available, mostly slanted toward the integrationist end of the spectrum. And here we arrive at Malcolm as a Pan-African internationalist. And I hope I'm not manipulating terminology in such a way to produce confusion. In fact, Abdul and myself, we've had some discussions recently as to how we get beyond the blanket integrationist terminology and really talk about what a king or a divorce is about, especially in the international realm where we see people who otherwise are known as nationalists come very close to people that, in terms of domestic politics, would be considered integrationists. And in terms of Malcolm, I've developed this language, Pan-African internationalist, and I think we were using with King, militant integrationism. I'm sure there's some even better terminology, but we're trying to work toward a term that expresses the convergence of what appears, on the other hand, disparate trends, as opposed to always using terminology, you know, that implies more separation than in fact is the case. So if you can bear with me, I'm going to talk about Malcolm as a Pan-African internationalist, although I've previously been discussing him as a revolutionary nationalist. I hope I can square this in. Black power became the orientation in the latter half of the 60s decade because Malcolm X struggled uncompromisingly to restore the Afro-American nationalist tradition in the first half of that tumultuous decade. Nevertheless, in his own way, Malcolm X was struggling to popularize Pan-African internationalism in the last months before his murder. Without the revolutionary nationalism and Pan-African internationalism of Malcolm X, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's white paper on black power, its white paper on Vietnam, on the Vietnamese War, in opposition to that war and US imperialism generally, would not have occurred when they did. James Forman, former Executive Secretary SNCC, had the following to say about Malcolm's influences on his organization's growing internationalism, and I'll quote very briefly. I read Malcolm X's speech carefully. His criticism of the term civil rights and his advocacy of human rights in its place led me to formulate a resolution that was adopted at the June 1967 staff meeting of SNCC. This resolution declared that SNCC considered itself to be a human rights organization working for the liberation not only of black people in the United States, but of all oppressed people, especially those in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. After the demise of SNCC, this internationalism was carried on by the Black Panther Party, a party whose leadership openly avowed their debt to Malcolm X. Malcolm foresaw that the struggle for black liberation had an international dimension, that it was a particular form of the general struggle for human rights. King, by 1966, had arrived at a similar position, but still wasn't able to accept what Malcolm X had accepted as given, that the struggle for human rights is a revolutionary struggle within which violence could be a liberating instrument. How does Malcolm look today? Is he still relevant in the 80s? As with so many prophets, much of what Malcolm said was misunderstood and repudiated by his own people in his own time. One contemporary commentator noted, and I'll quote, "The straightforwardness of his speech titillated his white listeners and frightened his Negro bourgeois audience. But that same kind of speech lifted the spirits of the tired black masses who had no one else to tell it like it was. Although in their hearts some of the Negro masses understood Malcolm and the nature of his message, their minds could not fully grasp the nature of his concept. Malcolm was at one and the same time talking to some of them, talking over the heads of most of them, and scaring the pants off the rest." End quote. In assessing Malcolm X's impact in the 60s, C.E. Wilson identified three milestones. First, Malcolm reestablished the black nationalist tradition within the integrationist movement of the civil rights movement. Wilson asserts that this development forced a space for the black urbanized working masses to articulate and act on their agenda. Second, Malcolm X offered a moral imperative in the black liberation struggle, which stood as an alternative to that advanced by Martin Luther King. Last, Malcolm stood as a role model for the development of activist cadres. His relevance is much clearer to those among the black masses who come in contact with his thought now in the middle of the 80s than it ever was during the 60s. One can no longer survive off Malcolm's charisma, but must now come to grips with the content of his intellectual output. The racist ravages of two decades have etched the relevance of his analysis deep into the social conscience of contemporary Afro-Americans. His work carries more force than ever before. His words are on the lips of blacks in Harlem, where every protest meeting sees speaker after speaker pay homage to the truth of his thoughts. Therefore, the central task of the 80s and thereafter for Afro-Americans is to rebuild the movement for Black liberation. Malcolm X is central to this effort, as his thought represents one of the critical sources for redefining and reformulating the concept of Black power. While he helped give birth to the era of Black power, Malcolm was not around to rescue it from the reformism that the Black petty bourgeoisie imposed upon it, Black capitalism and Black electoral politics within the Democratic Party. Interestingly, the three contributions cited by Wilson could be crucial to the rebuilding process of the 1980s. Malcolm X represents not just the Black nationalist tradition in Afro-American history. This tradition has two aspects, reactionary Black nationalism and revolutionary Black nationalism. Each aspect has its basis in different classes in the Afro-American community. The nationalism of the Black petty bourgeoisie today is reactionary and accommodationist. The revolutionary nationalism of Malcolm X originates in the mood of the working masses to resist and struggle against their oppression. In the BLM rebuilding process, Malcolm's revolutionary nationalist thought is important because it challenges the ideological hegemony of the Black petty bourgeoisie and leads directly to a serious consideration of alternatives. Malcolm X is politically relevant also as a liberation theologian. And of course, I recognize that I'm somewhat out of my depth here, as we have the scholar of Black liberation theology here, but I'll just take this opportunity to make certain observations. Today, the Black petty bourgeoisie advances an image of a Christian pacifist king, which obscures the foundations of Black liberation theology laid by King, especially in his last 2 years. Ironically, Malcolm, albeit as a Muslim minister, stands four square in the resistance tradition of the Black church. Perchance it will be through the moral imperative of Malcolm's witness, even more than a co-opted king, that Black liberation theology will become a part of a reconstructed Black liberation movement. Just a few words in summary here. Malcolm X has stood the test of time as a thinker and critic of the Black intellectual tradition. It is through Malcolm that the Black liberation movement was taught many of the principles undergirding revolutionary movements throughout the Third World. We have previously made reference to the important transition that Malcolm represents between King's Gandhi nonviolence and the redemptive violence of Fanon. Malcolm X is just as directly linked to the salient thought of an Emile Parker Brown or even a Mao Zedong. In his thought and in his living example, Malcolm told no lies and claimed no easy victories. He was a thinker with a scientific outlook who neither retreated from calling a spade, nor avoided the necessity of giving precedence to the struggle against our own weaknesses. Most important, through Malcolm, more and more ordinary Black people are able to transcend the particularity of their oppression and begin to visualize their day-to-day struggle as a local particular aspect of the more general international struggle for human rights, a revolutionary movement which is essentially a struggle for power.